Hi, I'm Jessica Steinberg.
And I'm Amanda Borchel Dunn. Welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing.
Your update on what's important in Israel, the Middle East,
and the Jewish world.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Briefing. Today is Monday, August 1st. I'm Ann Gordon, in for Amanda Borchel Dunn. I'm here today with U.S. correspondent Jacob Magid and reporter Luke Tress. Hello to you both.
Hey, Ann.
Hi, Ann.
The drug epidemic out of the United States has taken a new and deadly turn, as deaths from drugs have reportedly hit record highs in recent years. Overdoses account for 932,000 people in less than 25 years, mostly involving opioids. That was first in the form of prescription pills, then heroin, now fentanyl. We'll hear about these chilling developments and why fentanyl is particularly frightening. We'll also hear about how no segment of the American community, and that includes the Jewish community, is safe from this scourge. In another story out of the U.S., we'll hear about Jared Kushner's soon-to-be-released new tell-all memoir about his time in the White House as then-U.S. President Trump's senior advisor, and his take on U.S.-Israel policymaking. And we'll hear about Israel's security cabinet vote to withhold more than half a billion shekels from the Palestinian Authority to offset the money the PA pays to terrorists. Luke, let's start with you. Your recent piece about the rise of fentanyl use, and particularly unintentional fentanyl use, made for riveting yet really frightening reading. Tell us what fentanyl is, why it's taken hold, and why it's so, so bad.
So fentanyl is an opioid, which is a class of drugs that goes back to poppy plants and opium. Fentanyl is entirely synthetic, but it's in the same class of drugs because it works on the same receptors in the brain. So it's extremely potent. It's very hard to detect without equipment. And it's very dangerous because a very small amount, 2 milligrams, can be fatal. And what's been happening in recent years is that this drug crisis that goes back over 20 years to Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family with OxyContin. A lot of people got hooked on opioids through these pills that Purdue was pushing. Then the pills dried up under government pressure and people started using heroin. And then heroin became more scarce and fentanyl has really taken over the scene. So people who are addicted have turned to this because they don't have a choice, a lot of them, and for other reasons. Because it's so potent in small amounts, overdoses have just been going through the roof in recent years. There's over 100,000 deaths in the U.S. last year. And the big problem that's happening now is fentanyl is being put in pills that are disguised as prescription pills. So people buy, illegally, a fake OxyContin pill, which is supposed to have a certain dose of the drug, and it is actually fentanyl, and there's no way to know how much is in it. So these people take a single pill, and there ends up being a lethal dose in the pill, which kills them. And it's getting not only into opioid pills, but pills like Xanax and Adderall. So people who just have no experience with opioids and aren't expecting to take an opioid, so they don't realize they're at risk of an overdose, are taking these pills, and it's killing them. Opioid overdoses are now the leading cause of death for young people in America between the ages of 18 and 45.
Oh my. I just want to clarify. If somebody has a prescription and they go to the pharmacy, they fill the prescription, are they at risk of getting fentanyl instead? Or is this only, I don't know, if you're getting your pills off the street?
No, it's only illegal drugs. So let's say someone doesn't have a prescription to Xanax, but they want to take it recreationally or just take it illegally for whatever reason. They can buy it from a drug dealer. A lot of this is happening over social media. They'll find a dealer who is selling pills and they'll buy a pill that looks like Xanax, but is not actually Xanax. It's actually fentanyl. And that's essentially what's killing a lot of people. And in addition to fentanyl being cut into heroin and other drugs, like other illegal drugs such as cocaine and ecstasy.
Now, this is obviously stereotyping on my part, but I don't usually think of the Jewish community and certainly the religious ultra-Orthodox community as particularly prone to drug use, to street drug use. How is this affecting them?
When I was reporting this story, I was talking to addicts in the Jewish community and treatment providers and activists. And essentially every single person told me that description does not discriminate. So there's no data specifically on the Jewish community. There's some figures that like point to the problem, but there's no specific data. But essentially everyone said that the Jewish community and Jewish communities in the US are affected by this like every other community, including religious and non-religious. One of the people I spoke to was a treatment provider in New Jersey who has a residential substance abuse treatment facility. And the people who are there with serious problems with opioids and other problems, a lot of them are religious. About half of them were using opiates before they went into the treatment program.
Are these treatment programs effective for those who have been exposed now to fentanyl and are now addicted to it? Is there a light at the end of the tunnel? Can they come out?
So it's a serious addiction. It's very hard to break it. The treatments are not always effective. Like the person I spoke to, his name's Nate Nagelbutt. He works at a treatment program called Recovery at the Crossroads in New Jersey, which is mostly Jewish religious people. And he has some success stories. Some people really turn their life around, and some people get out of the treatment program and they relapse and they die of an overdose. So it's hit or miss for a lot of people. And then one of the addicts I spoke to for the story, we called him David because he didn't want to share his real name. He came from a religious background in Brooklyn, started using drugs around 10 years ago in college, eventually started using heroin, and then heroin dried up and he started using fentanyl with one of his friends, was really addicted. And then his close friend overdosed and died. He became really torn up about it and started using alone. And then he also overdosed on fentanyl. And he was saved by his dad, actually, while he was overdosing and taken to the hospital where they saved his life. And he went to a treatment facility and he did clear himself up. I spoke to him about a week ago, and he's doing great now. He's in a sober living house. He got a job. So yeah, some people do recover, and there are some success stories. But like a lot of people don't even get the chance. Like another person I spoke to was a mother whose son died. He had never even used opioids. He took a pill that had fentanyl in it, and it killed him just from one pill. The drugs are being manufactured basically in Mexico, most of them. A lot of the precursors for the drugs, like the ingredients for the drugs, come from China, and they're shipped into Mexico and then brought across the border.
It's a shame that the supply issues from China are not affecting this. This is really a terrible story. I hope that there is some recourse, that there's some solution in the offing, if they can develop an antidote type of thing. Thank you, Luke. It's a really hard story to read. I recommend that everybody go and read it, even though it's a hard story to read, because it really sheds light on, I think, a new wrinkle of these drug wars.
Can I just say, so the situation now is the epidemic is still ramping up. It's still accelerating. There's more deaths every year. It doesn't look like there's a lot of recourse right now, but people can do things to keep themselves more safe if they're using drugs, such as using with someone else who can keep an eye on them if they overdose, or have Narcan, which is an overdose treatment, with them, or they can test their drugs with strips that detect fentanyl before they use them. So while the crisis isn't slowing down, there are things individuals can do to keep themselves safe.
That's somewhat reassuring. Okay, at least that. And now for our break. When we return, we'll hear about Jared Kushner's new book.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like, my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their like blankie, their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic, because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, Daily Briefing listeners. I'm so happy you've joined us for our daily analysis of what's important in Israel, the Middle East, and the Jewish world. Like what you hear? Check out our Times Will Tell weekly podcast. Every Friday, you can hear conversations with authors, artists, archaeologists, and thought leaders from around the globe. Subscribe to Times Will Tell, our weekly half-hour feature, wherever you find your podcasts. Enjoy!
And we're back. Okay, Jacob, what is Jared Kushner saying that we didn't know before?
Hi, so Jared Kushner on August 23rd will be publishing his tell-all from his time in the White House. He'll be, I don't know, like the umpteenth Trump official to do that. I think it's a pretty standard procedure once you leave government. And Kushner definitely being the senior advisor to Trump and one of his closest aides has probably lots of juicy details that he can or cannot share, but he's at least sharing some of them in his new book. And I got a copy of it a few days ago, and I've been skimming through it to try to find some interesting anecdotes that would be interesting to our readers. And I found one that definitely caught my eye that was surrounding the unveiling of Trump's peace plan in January of 2020. Now, why it caught my eye was because I also did a review of David Friedman, who was the U.S. ambassador to Israel during the Trump administration. He wrote a book of his own that he published in February, and he tells this tale of a very smooth process from the get-go. The Trump administration had this grand plan that first they were going to unveil a peace plan, and then they were going to freak out the countries in the Arab world, and then a few of them were going to say, how about we make peace with Israel and normalize relations instead of you moving forward with this peace plan, which allows Israel to annex large parts of the West Bank. So Friedman talks about it as this grand plan. And I had asked him at the time, because there had been some reporting that I've done and some reporting that other reporters have uncovered, that there was actually a split in the White House between Friedman, who was very pro-annexation and allowing Israel to move forward with its plans to annex large parts of the West Bank. And then there was Kushner, who was more looking at it from above and kind of was also dealing with U.S. relations with other countries in the region and realized the danger that the move that Netanyahu wanted to move forward with posed if it went through. And at the time, I asked Friedman, is this true? Did Kushner and you not see eye to eye on this issue? Did you go behind his back and try to get Netanyahu to push for annexation in January 2020? And Friedman told me at the time, he said the following. He said, the accusation that I was running my own agenda with Netanyahu about applying Israeli sovereignty to large parts of the West Bank and not letting the president know, not letting anybody know, contrary to the wishes of Jared, it's 100% false, 100% false. So that was in February. And then in Kushner's book, I came across the passage where Kushner says basically that's not the case, that Netanyahu took his opportunity to speak during the unveiling ceremony of the peace plan to announce that he was going to be annexing large parts of the West Bank immediately in the coming days. This was not at all what the Trump administration had planned, at least according to Kushner. And he says, I grabbed my chair so intensely that my knuckles turned white as if my grip could make Bibi stop. So that was what he said as Netanyahu's announcement was happening in real time. And what was interesting is right after that, he says, as it turned out, Ambassador David Friedman had assured Bibi that he would get the White House to support annexation immediately. He had not conveyed this to me or anyone on my team. So he totally throws Friedman under the bus, which is kind of interesting because, I mean, it was known behind closed doors that they didn't have the greatest relationship, but to do it like this in a book is pretty startling. And just interesting the dynamic that the Trump administration was known to be very, very pro-Israel at the time and willing to do whatever the government and Netanyahu wanted. Clearly, there were limits to that policy, and one of those limits was on annexation. So then I reached out yesterday to David Friedman and asked him, okay, how do you square the circle after telling me that they were 100% in lockstep? He said that, sent me a statement saying, Jared and I have different recollections of those hectic days, but we agreed that we reconciled our differences in a manner that best served the U.S.-Israel relationship. And he stood by his recollection, which was very much contradictory to Kushner's. So you'll have to decide who you want to believe. I did write a review on Friedman's book in February that poked a lot of holes into the story that he tried to tell and called out a lot of certain inaccuracies that I found. So that does kind of damage his credibility a bit in the way he tells the story. But they both offer two very interesting narratives of what happened during those fateful days in January 2020.
We'll include the link to that review as well. I'm curious, and I know you don't really have the answer here, whether this is a case of he said, or whether there's somebody else is going to come forward and clarify.
So I did reach out to Netanyahu because he would be someone who would be able to verify one of the stories. If Friedman had told him that you have the green light to go ahead and announce your plans to annex the West Bank, then he would be able to tell me if that happened. Fortunately, his office didn't get back to me, and they're not used to usually kind of responding to those kind of requests from reporters. I do think, based on my reporting from not just speaking to Kushner, but speaking to others in the Trump administration and the Israeli government at the time, that Kushner's account is closer to the truth. I'm sure, believe that there are certain accuracies on both sides. I do think that to say that the Trump administration didn't have any plan to allow Israel to annex the West Bank might be a stretch, especially because their peace plan very specifically envisions that they will eventually, but it's maybe an issue of semantics. Obviously, it mattered a great deal at the time because it freaked out a lot of countries, and the Trump administration was found to be kind of scrambling after, and Trump was furious with Netanyahu's speech. I think it does seem to be that Kushner's account seems to be more closer to what I've understood happened, but I think Friedman's angle is also important to hear as well.
Okay, shifting gears, what does it mean that Israel is withholding $500 million from the Palestinian Authority? Can this backfire?
Yeah, good question. So Israel in 2018 passed a law requiring the government to withhold the equivalent amount of money that the PA is estimated to pay out to the security prisoners and terrorists and the families of slain attackers. And despite this being required by law, the Security Cabinet must nevertheless vote periodically to approve the move. So one of those votes came up on Sunday, and the Cabinet, despite being inclusive of left-wing parties who are very much more close to the PA and the support of Palestinian state, the majority of the Cabinet voted in favor of withholding these funds. But there was an interesting debate in the cabinet about whether it's really worth doing this step, because every so often Israel sends a loan to the Palestinians to offset for these tax refunds that it's not giving them back because of the policy of paying, it's known amongst Israelis as pay to slay, and seen as encouraging violence against Israelis, but they're still offsetting these funds with loans because they don't want the PA to collapse. I think there's a very clear understanding in the Israeli security establishment and almost across, definitely from left to center right of the political spectrum, that we don't want the PA to collapse, and therefore withholding billions of shekels is not really in our interest at the end of the day. I think the PA sees this policy differently than obviously it's seen in Israel. It's seen as kind of, a lot of the security prisoners in Israeli jails are not, quote unquote, definitely they don't see them as terrorists, but a lot of them are just being arrested in kind of these nightly raids and accused of maybe throwing stones without downgrading the seriousness of those crimes. But their punishments are much more severe than ones that Jews receive for those same kinds of crimes. And they're put in jails for long periods of time, and they're without any financial backing, and that's why governments, it's not just in the Palestinian Authority, but other governments around the world are known to have welfare programs where they pay a certain amount of people in prison. And Palestinians try to paint this program where they also, it's part of their welfare program, and it's a segment of it, and they try to paint it as no different than any other part of their welfare program. The argument against that is that obviously the amount that people get in jail is based off of the amount of the length of their prison term, meaning that you're likely going to get way more money if you commit a much more violent act. There's been talk over the years that the PA, in the past, specifically the past couple of years during the Biden administration, that they might be willing to reform their policy to make the payments based off of just the economic need as opposed to time served. And that might be a way to get around the Taylor Force Act, similar legislation in the U.S. that requires, that bars PA to the PA. But I don't think it's going to be changed in the future.
Has there been a response from the PA?
Yeah, I mean, they're furious because this is money that they say is rightfully theirs, and that Israel has no right to be deducting these tax funds from their budget. And I think they warn that this will cause instability in the region. And if the PA collapses, that Israel will be the one to pay because they'll be the ones that will have to all of a sudden be in control of millions of Palestinians in the West Bank. And that's like the apartheid concern that Israelis have, or the other Israeli security officials and governments in the past have had, that if we allow the PA to collapse, we're the ones that have to pay. And then we're suddenly in charge of pretty much a majority of Palestinians, or close to a majority, between the river and the sea.
A story to watch, as always. That's it for today's Daily Briefing. Thank you, Jacob. Thank you, Luke. Until next time.
Bye.
Thanks, Anne.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. And thanks to our producer, Gilad Brownstein, and to Gili Amar for this out-of-this-world music.
You can find us daily wherever you find your podcasts.
And on our mothership, timesofisrael.com. Like what you hear? Consider rating us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify to spread the word.
And be sure to check out our weekly feature, Times Will Tell, released every Friday. Until next time.
Shalom.